There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into the conversations as ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? There's been some talk in the last 24 hours about salty speech. Curious to know, from the Christian perspective, do you actually know what salty speech looks like versus the profane nature of salty speech in the world? There you go. There's a 10-second tidbit for you to chew on in the concept of how we get God back into the conversations of the day. People don't need another piece of our mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? Hey, you can connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We got all kinds of resources posted there for you. While you're there, we invite you to sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary that we don't have time to share here on the air. You could also like The Reconnect on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, pretty much for the last several days, the news cycle has been obsessed. They've basically just been obsessed with Anthony Scaramucci, who, if you're not familiar with his name yet, he is the new director of communications for the White House. He had what I will just describe as a profanity-laden rant, and it was recorded in a conversation that he did not have. He did not say to the reporter was off the record or on background, which are things that you absolutely need to do if you don't want to find the recordings of your conversations then published in all kinds of places, in this case, the New York Post. So pretty much the news cycle for the last several days has been obsessed with this profanity-laden rant. Now, meanwhile, in that same period of time, some really remarkable things actually happened that you may have missed. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback has been appointed to serve as the United States Ambassador of International Religious Freedom. Why does that matter? Well, because the United States is actually fairly unique in our advocacy for religious freedom, not just for people here in the United States, but around the world. If you hold it as a value that you are allowed to believe or not believe in any particular religion, if you hold it as a value that people can convert from one religion to another, then you are, come to find out, a religious freedom advocate. And out there in the world, where there are lots of countries where people are not simply free to believe whatever they believe, there is a state religion, there is the state telling people that they cannot believe in God, they cannot practice a particular religion or religion at all. We would say that advocacy for religious minorities around the world, minority religious groups in, let's see, so yes, Christians who live in Muslim-majority countries, but also Muslims who live in Hindu-majority countries, or Hindus and Buddhists who live in communist countries. I mean, just go down. You can work your way all over the list here. So advocacy for international religious liberty and religious freedom is, America is unique in that we actually have a person who goes out there and does this for us. You might recognize the name David Saperstein. He has held this position for a period of time. He is a guy who I highly, I just admire him greatly. Sam Brownback is equally admirable, and certainly in his time in Washington worked admirably on these issues, and I expect him to do so in this new position as well. So certainly want to prayerfully support the Senate's confirmation of Sam Brownback to this position as an ambassador of religious freedom, international religious freedom. The president also awarded the Medal of Honor to the Capitol Hill police officers who very bravely intervened when 6 weeks ago a gunman took out after members of the Republican Party who were practicing for the congressional baseball game. You will remember that in that shooting, Steve Scalise was seriously injured, took a gunshot wound to the hip, major blood loss, and then even as they put him back together, suffered an infection that landed him back in intensive care during the last month. He has, just as of this week, been moved from the hospital into an intensive rehab unit. So all of that has been happening. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, took a trip to El Salvador in order to demonstrate the commitment that the United States has to bringing an end to the kind of gang violence that we experience because of unaccompanied minors coming to the United States who are actually just people who belong to these international gangs, in this case, a gang called MS-13. So the president is very serious about confronting the violence, particularly in places like Long Island, where MS-13 has been involved in many murders, and hundreds of MS-13 gang members have been arrested. The same would be true then in El Salvador. This is a cooperative effort between the two countries. The sanctions bill related to North Korea, Iran, and Russia has passed both houses of Congress. The appropriations bill, which includes funding for the border wall, went through this week. You probably didn't even know that. And research tells us that in the midst of all of that, you've been out there doing a lot of good. That's right. Christians have been out there this week as a part of the efforts of churches across the country. You've been out there doing good. Now, none of that probably rose to the level of what the media, locally or nationally, spent a whole lot of time talking about. And maybe even at your own church, folks aren't talking about all the good stuff that Christians are doing across the country. So I did want to highlight for you today this Lifeway Research study that talks about good deeds being done by Christians that often go unseen. Now, as soon as I say that, you're going to say, well, that's because we're not supposed to let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. Okay, that is actually an instruction related to financial contributions and giving. Like, right, you're not supposed to be, you know, celebrating that you are making some kind of financial sacrifice on behalf of the kingdom of God. But in terms of your good deeds, we have reached the point, according not only to this Lifeway research, but based on some research that I remember reading from Q last year. There's a guy named D. Alsop that did research last year and the year before related to the same subject. There's a lot of good that's happening through churches that Christians are doing that our neighbors just don't know about. They don't know that we are out of our Christian conviction actually motivated to do good for our neighbors and for our neighborhoods. So this Lifeway research that was just posted on Facts and Trends, so you can go grab that, says this. When you think about the areas of service that our neighbors have heard about, that local churches are engaged in, people apparently know that churches are feeding people. So 60% of our neighbors know that we're feeding the hungry. 50% know that we're clothing the poor. 40% know that we're helping out disaster victims. A third of the population knows that Christian churches are seeking to shelter the homeless. But then you get down to, like, you know, 25%, and then it drops down pretty precipitously from there in terms of people's knowledge that we are visiting people in prison, offering after school programming, supporting our local schools, providing aid for new moms, tutoring kids, on and on and on and on. OK, so I want you to think for a moment about the good that you do. Maybe motivated out of the golden rule. Right? We're doing unto others what we would have them do unto us if we found ourselves in similar circumstance. Maybe we're motivated out of the least of these, our brothers and sisters' commands of Jesus, that what we do to the least of these, we do unto Christ. Maybe we are people who really genuinely do want to hear from the Lord. Well done, good and faithful servant. Maybe we're recognizing that to whom much has been given, from us, much is required. Like, we recognize the extravagant blessing that it is to live where we live and have access to the resources to which we have access. I was surprised in reading this that only 12% of people surveyed know that Christians and churches are providing foster care, or even the numbers related to visiting with or interacting with people in prison. That's really the knowledge or awareness of that happening is only at a 25% level in the culture at large. I find that kind of surprising. And then I thought to myself, I spent a minute, I was thinking, okay, if I were asked that same question, You see, I would answer the question that I know Christians are doing this, and I know parachurch ministries are doing this, but if the question is asked to me, do I know that it's happening specifically through local churches, I might have answered the question the same way. People, individuals motivated to provide foster care, provide foster care. Churches don't provide foster care. People, individual Christians motivated to go, who are equipped to do so, who are compelled to do so, go and visit people in prisons. Local churches don't go visit prisons. So Christians who are part of local churches are the ones doing these things, whether or not it's the express ministry of a particular local congregation. As wired in as I am to my own church and lots of other churches, I don't even know that I would have the answer to that question in this way, because I would say, hey, the ministries that I know that are engaged in these things are actually parachurch ministries. It's the parachurch ministry called Focus on the Family that I know about that's doing amazing work in the area of foster care. Or it's Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson's ministry, that's really doing extraordinary work in terms of prisons and prisoners. It's Samaritan's Purse, which is Franklin Graham's ministry that really is the one that's on the forefront of disaster relief. Now, do I know that there are denominations engaged in those things as well? Yes. And are those then populated by Christians who attend local churches? Yes. But is it local churches that's doing those things? I don't know the answer to that question. Here's my point in sharing all of this. My sister, her name is Tiana. She has a little horn, it looks like a bike horn, and it sits next to her computer on her desk. Because you know what? Every once in a while, you have to toot your own horn. You know, everybody out there in the world doesn't necessarily know all the good that you're doing. And sometimes you got to toot your own horn, right? You got to keep yourself moving in the direction of the positive things that each and every one of us is called to do on behalf of Christ. And sometimes that means you actually have to be your own megaphone. It's not braggadocious. It's not prideful for you and I to be sharing the good things that are happening through the life and ministry of Christ people on the earth. Our neighbors need to know. If our neighbors knew just how much Christians and Christian churches were actually doing to bring positive good and positive transformation in the lives of children and young people and new moms and the homeless. I mean, just work your way down the list of the least of these, our brothers and sisters among whom we live. I have to tell you that I wholeheartedly believe they would have a greater appreciation for the presence of our churches in the community. They would not view us as people that are just trying to get a tax break with those big buildings. All right, there's a lot going on in the world. I saw this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and I want to make you aware of it. It is a plea by a mainline Protestant woman for churches of all varieties, pastors of all kinds of churches. She says, "I offer a plea to all religious leaders on the left and on the right. If you're considering involving your churches in political debates, please don't. Don't actively work against those sitting in your pews who agree with Christ's message, but disagree about using government programs to advance it. Instead, focus on the individual acts of mercy that matter most." All right, so it's an excellent op-ed. I would send you to it. It's at the Wall Street Journal, and it's entitled, "Why Not a Day of Rest from Politics? Mainline Protestant Pastors Are More Left-Leaning Than Their Parishioners." Highly recommend that article to you and that idea for your consideration, that maybe, at least at church, we stay out of politics and focus on Jesus Christ and the proclamation of the gospel and the advancement of it always in all ways. All right, friends, in addition to the program that you are listening to, which is called the Reconnect with Carmen LaBurge, we also have a one-minute program called Reconnect One. And we're excited to share with you that Reconnect One is now available nationwide on 450 radio stations in the Christian Satellite Network. So if you wanted to check out a radio station near you where you might hear Reconnect One live, you can go to Christian Satellite Network and check out their list of stations. You can also listen to Reconnect One, all kinds of them. We got a whole treasure trove of them now at Reconnect with Carmen.com. I thought today I'd just give you a sample of what Reconnect One sounds like.
Reconnect One with Carmen LaBurge.
Ah, the good old days. Those were when exactly? And exactly for whom were they good? You see, the good old days for which we pine were not so good for everyone. Good is always relative. Well, except for the one time when it was not. To really get back to the good old days, we have to go all the way back. So the next time you hear someone use the phrase good old days, walk them right back to Genesis chapter 1, where God saw what he had made and declared it to be good. We can only get back to a time when things were good by going forward into God's redemptive plan for history. That's right. We can only go back to the good old days by going forward into the glory God offers. And there's only one way to get there, through a Friday called good and a man called Jesus.
Reconnect today's headlines with God's perspective. Visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.
All right, friends, I hope you enjoyed that. Go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and check out some of our other Reconnect Ones. It's a really fun thing to share with your friends. It's easy to share. It's literally just a one-minute commentary. And while you're at the website, we'd appreciate your support as we seek to share this good news with more and more people. We would love to help your neighbors and your friends reconnect the eternal with the everyday. All right, I want to spend a little time today talking about the fact that there's a right way and a wrong way to treat people. It's hard for me to imagine that we even need to be having this conversation today, but apparently not everybody knows that there's a right way and a wrong way to treat people. We're just actually talking about very basic behavior standards here. So I'm gonna share with you what I believe is the right way to treat other people, and I'll use the golden rule as the simplest example: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I would use Matthew 18, where Jesus actually instructs us in relationship to what we should be doing in our communication with one another, what we should be doing, how we should be operating if in fact we have offended one another, sinned against one another. So in chapter 18 of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. And if he listens to you, you've won your brother over. If he won't listen, then take it to two others. So every matter will be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So there we're talking about, like, right, you're going to start by going to the person on an individual level. And then if you need to bring somebody else into the conversation, you do that. If that doesn't resolve things, then you take it to whatever sort of the higher order group is. If it's inside the church, you're going to take it to your session, or you're going to take it to your board of deacons. If we're talking about the government, you know, and you're talking about folks working together in government, you know, maybe you got to take it to the cabinet. Here's the deal. There's a right way to do this, and there's a wrong way to do it. So when Jesus says, I do think one clarifying point here is important. When Jesus says, if your brother sins against you, what does he mean by brother? That's one of the questions that would arise immediately in this conversation. Does he mean biological brother? No, he does not. Does he mean nationality? You know, like, you're my brother. No, he does not. When Jesus is defining brother in this particular context, we have to remember that it was just in Matthew chapter 12 that Jesus's own family, his mother and his biological brothers, came to an event where he was speaking, and there was a large crowd gathered, and they were trying to get, you know, sort of like up to the front to him. And people were saying, hey, your mom and your brothers are outside and they're trying to get you. And Jesus says, who are my mother and my brothers? And he defines it for us. He says, my mother and my brothers are those who do the will of my Father in heaven. So when Jesus is talking here about our relationships with one another, he really is, in fact, talking about our relationships with one another as Christians, those who are engaged in relationship or in a restored relationship with God through Jesus Christ as our Savior. So now I'm gonna apply all of that to what's going on in our culture right now, to what I'm going to describe as the totally wrong way. The wrong way to treat other people, the wrong way to communicate. And we have these glaring examples, frankly, of the president's treatment of his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, the director of communications for the White House, Anthony Scaramucci's very profane laden rant against his White House colleagues. We have the president's announcement on Twitter this week of something that he hadn't actually worked through on the policy level with the military, undercutting his own guys. So there are ways to communicate that are effective and appropriate, and then there are a whole host of ways that are ineffective and inappropriate in terms of our communication with one another. And so I simply want to encourage you to take the Matthew 18 model seriously. Take the Matthew 18 model seriously. If someone has offended you, do not take to Twitter. Do not take to Facebook. Do not take to Instagram. Do not, frankly, take out against them in public in any way. Do not pick up the phone and call the first reporter whose number happens to be on your speed dial. Get face to face with the person whom you believe has offended you. Tell them what it is that you are concerned about and see what they have to say. Because, in fact, it may be that the information that was shared was publicly available anyway, and that the person that you think did it had nothing to do with it. It could also be that you are not being well served by the other people who are constantly speaking into your ear about issues, when in fact there are people who are in a position to make really good decisions. So I'm going to use the example here of the president announcing on Twitter something in relationship to banning transgender people from the military. He announced it as if it was a done deal. He announced it as if this was policy, when in fact, that's not where the military is on these things. And you cannot make law. You cannot set policy on Twitter. It's not actually a part of the chain of command of the military. Does the president, as the commander in chief, have authority to boss the military around? Absolutely. He's the commander in chief. He can command the military. However, this is a particular policy in relationship to service and service members and their families and health care and all kinds of other things that have to be taken into account when we're talking about this kind of sweeping change, or actually returning to a practice that was that the military had been engaged in for a very long period of time. Until up and recently, when President Obama actually allowed transgender people to serve openly in the military. So here you go. There's the confusion. I think there's a right way of communicating with one another, and there is a wrong way. Okay. Finally, today I want to talk about what's going on in Jerusalem, and I want to invite you to be praying for the situation there. I know we have talked about this this issue a little bit. This escalating violence surrounding issues regarding the Temple Mount. So I wanted to bring you up to date because Friday is the day, or at this point was the day when folks were most concerned about disturbances and demonstrations in the old city of Jerusalem, particularly in relationship to the Temple Mount, particularly in the incitement of violence among those who regard themselves as Palestinians over and against the Israelis, who they view as, quote unquote, occupying what Jews would call the Temple Mount, what Muslims would call the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So here we go. The expected violence in Jerusalem comes after Muslims renewed prayer on the Temple Mount on Thursday, almost a week after boycotting prayers at the holy site. And you will recall that all of that was in response to the fact that Israel put metal detectors and security cameras in place after the July 14 terror attack near the Temple Mount, where, frankly, Muslim terrorists used the Temple Mount as a sniper post to take out Israeli security. So there's a lot of there are a lot of clashes reported on the West Bank between Palestinians and the IDF. There are clashes reported in a number of cities. But I'll just give you this. The cities would include Bethlehem, Nablus, Hebron, Kfar Qaddam, and at the Tomb of Rachel. And then there's this. In interviews with Israeli television, Palestinians said the conflict is not yet over, and they continue to be upset that there is an age limit set for those entering the Temple Mount, and they regard what Israel is doing as a continuing, quote, occupation of the Temple Mount, and they want to see Israel removed from there, which you will recall it was the issue of a six-day war only 50 years ago. So pray for the peace of Jerusalem. It is the mandate of Scripture in Psalm 122. And so I'll just remind you that you and I need to be praying for the peace of Jerusalem. Okay, folks, that's all we got time for in this half. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Art Rayner about God and your money. Visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Hey friends, welcome back. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? Well, and when do we do that? And where do we do that? Today is actually strike up a conversation in the elevator day. So there you go. If you have not yet struck up a conversation today, an elevator is kind of an exciting place to do that. So go ahead and give that a try. Hey, we're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And when we talk about the kingdoms of this world, the people on Forbes's list really top the chart. So we're going to talk about that in our Below the Fold. But before we get there, we're going to have a conversation with Art Rayner. Art is the Vice President of Institutional Advancement at Southeastern Theological Seminary. He holds a Doctor of Business Administration and an MBA. He's written several books, including Raising Dad, Simple Life, and The Minister's Salary. His latest is called The Money Challenge, 30 Days of Discovering God's Design for You and Your Money. You can check it all out at themoneychallengebook.com. That's themoneychallengebook.com. You can also follow Art on Twitter at Art Rayner. So Art, welcome to the Reconnect.
Hey, thank you, Carmen. I appreciate it.
Hey, as we're talking about the money challenge, why don't you just cast the vision first, and then we'll go into the details of the how-to. So you say being rich is not the answer, and financial health is not even the final answer, so there's something more. Financial health is not itself an end.
God has a design for us and how we are to use our money, all the resources that he has given us. He designed us, and I say this, a few times in the book, he's designed us not to be hoarders, meaning that we're not supposed to hold on to the things that he has given us, but we're to be conduits through which his generosity flows. We're to live with open hands to do and to give as he tells us to give.
Yeah, so I love that. I love that this. I love the conduit image. I love that you set this up as a story. Maybe we could frame for people what God's design is for our money. Help them understand what those components are.
Well, you can really break it down into three simple components. We are first told to give generously throughout the Bible. We see God telling us and directing us that the giving is to be a priority with our finances. Next, we see the need to save wisely. You know, we're not told to just give away everything all the time. Now, some people are called to that, so I don't want to take that away from anybody. But we are also told to save wisely, to make sure that we have money prepared for the future. For us, often that means retirement. On a closer timeline. Sometimes it's just having 3 to 6 months worth of savings set aside. And then finally, we're supposed to live appropriately. I mean, that we can absolutely enjoy the things that God has given us, but we must consider the ramifications of those, whether it's purchase decisions that we make. And all of this is not, as we mentioned earlier, it's not for the sake of just financial health. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. In fact, in the book, we spend a lot of time talking about how to become financially healthy, but it's so that we can get to a place where we have very limited hindrances. We have very limited what I would call generosity killers in our lives, so that when we feel compelled to give, we're able to do so without reservation. We're not first concerned about paying the credit card bill or the car loan bill. We can give as God desires us to give.
So I love that, and folks, we're talking about the Money Challenge. You can check it out at themoneychallengebook.com, and my conversation partner is Art Rayner, who is the author of the book. I appreciate the illustration that runs throughout the book, right? I appreciate these real characters, these people who aren't just flat. They actually, you develop these characters very well, and I found myself resonating particularly with Annie, but I certainly recognized the other characters in the story. And the lifestyle choice section, I will just tell you, you know, like, right, I'm nodding up and down to the generosity part. I'm nodding up and down to the save wisely part. And then, man, you get right into my business, right? When you start talking about lifestyle choices and you start talking about living appropriately. So let's just talk about that for a minute. We live in a culture or a world of what I would call hyper-consumerism and instant gratification. So when we talk about living appropriately as Christians in this context, how do you, just talk with us about that. How do you see that?
Well, first of all, we need to understand as Americans our position in the world as it relates to finances. The vast majority of this, and probably many have heard this before, the vast majority of us, from a global standpoint, are considered incredibly rich. We're in the top percentile as far as individual wealth goes in the world. So we're in a very wealthy position. Even there's going to be some of those that say, no, there's no way I am incredibly wealthy. Have you seen what I have compared to my neighbors? And that's part of the problem. But from a global standpoint, we are a very wealthy people. There was a book that I read, and I referenced it in the Money Challenge, called God and Money. and they asked a question that really just hit me in the teeth. They said, all along we have been asking the wrong question. We continue to ask, how much should we give? That's the typical question. Is it 10%? Is it 12%? Is it how much should we give? They said, we've been asking the wrong question. The real question we should be asking is, how much should we keep? And so it flips everything on its head. We develop a lifestyle plan for ourselves, and I'm not going to say that this is how much you should spend in a given year, and this is how this much person should spend in a given year. That's a decision between you and God. But when you do hit that point, that is when, from there on, your generosity should flow.
So, I will say that as a young adult, I had exposure to an older couple whose names are Fred and Jan. And when Fred started playing for the NFL, it was back in the day when you also had to have another job. And whatever little town it was that he was like going door to door selling books in the off season, one of the people that he met was the local banker. And the local banker said, I want you to come in. I want you to sit down with me because you're going to need a financial plan for your life because, you know, you are going to make more money than you're making now. And in that conversation, that banker laid out for Fred basically what you and I would view as an absolutely Christian game plan for his financial future. And he told him, he basically taught him about tithing at that point. And so even though it was really, really hard for them, it was a major sacrifice at that point for them to, you know, give 10%. But the commitment the banker asked them to make was to continue living on the amount that they were making then and see if, as God blessed them, they couldn't increase the giving side instead of increasing the consumption side. Well, by the time I met them, which was some 30 years later, and Fred had a very successful career in the NFL and ended up being a coach, they were giving away 90% and living on 10%.
Wow.
And so I just think that if you can get people young, and that's one of the things you talk about. You talk about, you know, the what if. You sort of lay out for people, you know, what if at 16 you'd put away $2,000 each summer, you know, at when you retire you'd have $600,000. That's pretty impactful, just that two-page chart. I think there's just a lot of people, Art, that are operating without any financial information because they didn't grow up with parents who taught them, and they didn't have, you know, a banker who said, come sit down with me and explain it to you. So invite people into the Money Challenge as a book because it's not intimidating. Tell people about, you know, its brevity and its sort of intentionality and its 30-day outline.
Well, I have had significant experience in teaching people about their personal finances. I actually have a banking background. And so I understand that the vast majority of individuals have absolutely no desire to sit down and read a massive book on financial health. They would rather go to the dentist and get a tooth pulled than have to endure a book like that. And so as I thought through, and I had individuals in my mind as I wrote the book, as I thought about them and the type of book that they would want to read, I first knew that it must be brief, as you had mentioned. The Money Challenge is a pretty concise book. It's less than 150 pages long. And then I knew that there needed to be something else in there other than just a bunch of financial knowledge. And so woven throughout the Money Challenge is, first of all, a fictional story about a girl or a lady named Annie. She is a recent college graduate, and she's faced with the many challenges that that millennials are faced. But it's not just millennials. Many generations are faced with the challenges that she's faced. And so we follow Annie on this journey, on her journey to become financially healthy. She runs into a banker that helps her understand God's design for her and her money. And we follow this story. So that's part of it. The other part is that at the end of each chapter, the reader is presented with a few money challenges. Now, these challenges are not, they do not just involve your money. Some of them do. But some of them are just about understanding what it's like to experience the generous life that God has designed us to live. You know, there's a study that's referenced in the Money Challenge. It's done by a lady named Elizabeth Dunn. And Elizabeth Dunn, she researches the relationship between money and happiness. She's very well known for this research. Study after study that she and others have done reveals that when we use our money for purposes outside of ourselves, then we actually get the most happiness out of it. And it's the most enduring happiness. We look back on those moments with little regret when we use money for things outside of ourselves, whether it's giving to our church, giving to our favorite charity, giving to some of our friends. Those things bring us greater contentment and greater satisfaction. And what I see when I read those studies is God's design woven in us. That's why we are designed to do that with our money. The Bible tells us to do it, and then studies outside of the Bible that it actually happens.
So I think that when you talk about these money challenges that come, or these challenges really that come at the end of every chapter, I do want to say to people, there's a lot of these challenges that are, it's something like, you know, write out this particular Bible verse and put it on your mirror. And that's what you're going to, you know, you're going to just focus intentionally on what God has said about this particular thing. And some of those, you know, are frankly not specifically about money. I also loved the one where you just say very intentionally do what the Word of God says in this particular thing. And it's let other people go first. So, you know, even if you're standing in line, physically let the other person go first. When you're going through a door, actually let other people go first. I just thought that in terms of very tangible, immediately applicable, totally everyday, not generationally specific, applicable to every socioeconomic category, and absolutely accessible to any level of reader, the Money Challenge really has all of that, in addition to inviting us to give generously, save wisely, and live appropriately, which you articulate as God's design for our money, which you derive from the Scriptures. So thank you for the Money Challenge. Let me ask Nice one more question before we let you go, and thank you for being so generous with your time today, Art. Randall, for those of you who have not yet read the book and will do so, it's at themoneychallengebook.com. Randall is in crisis. He's a guy who's begging for his daily bread on the street corner. We all know a Randall. We may not know Randall's name yet, but we all know a Randall. And Randall, he creates this crisis of conscience for every single one of us. I mean, I think there's no question that as Christians, we are moved to compassion, to give every time we see Randall. And yet there is this, you know, there is this other part of us that wants Randall to not be in that circumstance. We want Randall to be a contributing member of society. So what do we do with that very honest conflict of conscience when we're trying to, you know, get our own financial house in order and we recognize the depth of the need around us?
That's right. Well, the Bible tells us to, first of all, be generous. We can't avoid that. And it tells us that that's to be a priority in our lives, even in the midst of financial struggles. The Bible does not provide an exclusion clause as it relates to generosity. Now, we do need to be wise with our stewardship. So when we give, we need to consider the impact, the kingdom advancing impact that it will have, and invest wisely. And we also, in addition to that, need to balance the calling that God has on our lives in that moment where we feel compelled to give. But once again, financial struggles are real. They cause hurt. They cause pain. Most Americans seem to be experiencing some type of financial stress in their lives. If you look at the statistics, they're daunting right now. The amount of debt that we have, and the the challenges that finances are giving marriages now. The pain is real. And so I understand all that. And there's going to be a desire to hold on to money, to hold on to every single penny that you have. But as we look at Scripture, unavoidable. God has designed us to be, not to be hoarders, but to be conduits through which His generosity flows. And that is something that each of us must wrestle with. And the Money Challenge helps us to do just that.
All right, friends, the book is The Money Challenge, 30 Days of Discovering God's Design for You and Your Money. The website is themoneychallengebook.com. The author's Art Rayner. You can find him at artrayner.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Art Rayner. Art, thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen. I appreciate it.
So this is the point in the show where we like to go below the fold and lift up stories and make connections designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and their living. So when it comes to money, we know that this is a God subject. We've been talking about that with Art Rayner. But this caught my attention this week. Jeff Bezos briefly surpassed Bill Gates to become the world's richest person. Now, when we have conversations about the world's richest person, we're talking about numbers that most of us, frankly, cannot imagine. But the Amazon founder, Jeff Bezos, surpassed Bill Gates on Thursday to become the world's richest person. Bloomberg reported that a surge in Amazon stock helped propel Bezos to the top of the rich list. Apparently, Forbes has this like ongoing gauge of the richest people in the world. And so for a period of time, because of his Amazon stock, he surpassed Microsoft founder Bill Gates for a short period of time, who has actually topped the list since 2013. Now, by the end of the trading day on Thursday, Bill Gates was back in the top spot. So apparently his $90 billion fortune edged out Jeff Bezos's very close second $89 billion. I don't even know what you call it at that point. Portfolio? Wealth? I don't know. We're talking at this point about, frankly, obscene amounts of money. So it got me thinking, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Now, I'm not saying that either one of these guys is lost. I'm just saying that this kind of wealth provokes the conversation about the measure of a man or whether or not this is actually now how we're measuring things in our culture. So that's really the conversation I want to provoke you to have, both with yourself and with others today. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world? Does it matter if you got $89 or $90 billion if you don't know Christ? And do you understand as a Christian that in knowing Christ, the whole wealth of heaven actually belongs to you as a child of God? Like, do you get that? Do you get that everything that belongs to God is yours because you're His child, you're His beloved, you are an heir of the kingdom of heaven? There was an ancient Greek philosopher named Protagoras, and Protagoras said this: man is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things. Now, by that, he basically meant, look, the individual human being, rather than God or any sense of an unchanging moral law, that's really the ultimate source of value. That's really how we're measuring things. What do you say to that? Is man the measure of all things? In our culture, do we act as if man is the measure of all things? Do we act as if our decisions, our preferences, our personal desires, our will, our way, our productivity, our wealth, our families, our education, whatever it is, do we act as if man is the measure of all things? Or do we as Christians understand that there is actually a measure against which all lives are being weighed? I mean, that's ultimately the question. And it's not as if our life is weighed in a balance and found wanting. I don't want you to think about it that way. I don't want you to think as if God is weighing your good deeds and your bad, because this is not a works righteousness conversation. But if man is not the measure of all things, then what is the measure of a man? That's the question for today. If man is not the measure of all things, then what is the measure of a man? What is the chief end of man is another way of thinking about this question. And the Westminster, all of the Westminster standards, which many Christians today would understand as a good touch point in terms of theological understanding, they would say, okay, the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Is that what we're really busy doing? Am I measuring my life based on how much glory I'm bringing to God and how much joy I'm bringing to him? God actually tells the prophet Amos that he is measuring the people's sins against the plumb line he has set. Now, you and I both know that the plumb line that God has set is the law. And the standards of the law are justice and righteousness. And when we compare ourselves to the law, man, we all come up short, right? We all come up short if measured against the law. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But the good news of the gospel is this, that when we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So the question of how do I measure up against the law? And my answer to the question is Jesus. Jesus measures up to the law. He absolutely satisfies it. He satisfies the holiness of God and the righteousness of God and the justice of God by the mercy of God. So ultimately, no one of us could measure up to the fullness of the law. Remember the story of the rich young man or the rich young ruler. But in Jesus, God offers the new covenant in which he satisfies the full measure of his own holiness through the outpouring of his own love. That is grace, abundant, magnificent. And you can't measure it. Like, right? There's no actual way to measure the grace and the goodness and the mercy of God. It is so abundant and overwhelming, you'd never be able to measure it. So, back to the question. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world? $89, $90 billion, if he doesn't have an active relationship with God restored through Jesus Christ by God's own grace, that he's going to ultimately be measured against, right? So there you go. That's what I offer you today in terms of a headline that might have caught your attention, probably is catching the attention of the most wealthy people in the world and people who are pursuing the dollar as a way of measuring their own life. I want you to encourage people that ultimately their life is not going to be measured by how much money they make, but by the treasures stored up for them in heaven, where moth cannot eat and rust cannot dissolve. All right, friends, that's where I want to be storing up my treasures in heaven. This is The Reconnect, and I'm Carmen LaBurge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. Donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new, and this weekend, take the opportunity to actually engage someone in a conversation that glorifies God. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.